Hello. Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Paul. Thanks to everyone here at Albion for having us. We're honoured to be here. Just to let you know, there are 6 readers billed, but only 4 have made it tonight. Two are afraid to come to Cork, so reputation out here precedes us. We're going to have a mixture of poetry and fiction tonight for our readers. And also, you might see up here, I've got a bell here, and if you hear this noise, that means that the reader has been very bold and has overstepped their allotted mark, their time mark. And so moving swiftly on, our first reader is Breed Buckley. Breed is a Cork native. Breed is well known in these parts, having previously read here in At O'Vail and then seen. Tonight is her triumphant return. She has also read her poetry at Over the Edge in Galway and in the Tuam Arts Festival and the Ballyferriter Arts Festival. And in 2010, Breed was one of the winners of the Some Blind Alley's Fiction of Future competition. So she's got a bright future ahead of her, and her present is also pretty bright. Please welcome Breed Buckley.
Everyone, it's great to be back here, kind of where everything started for me, so it's an honour to be back here and reading. This is called Care Assistant. She thinks that I'm ugly. I take these words from out of her mouth silently, but I can see them lying latent there in the curl of her lip. Your trousers are too long for you, she says, and what she means is that my legs are not of a respectable length. Your fringe is in your eyes, she says. And what she means is, what is wrong with you that you would not get your hair cut, that you could not be tidy. It is cramped in this small bathroom. There really is not room for both our bodies. She stands before me completely naked and decides that I am ugly. I wash her wrinkled body in the technically correct manner. I'm a care assistant. That's the correct professional term. I wear a blue smock and sometimes people mistake me for a nurse. The white towel I hand her is stiff with starch. Kathleen tells me I'm holding it at the incorrect angle. What she is really saying is that I am so wearingly ugly that it pains her to look me in the face. There is a moment of awkward silence. I decide to be professional. Perhaps she is lonely. 78 years spent accumulating life experience and nobody to talk to about what she heard on the radio. She is a family. They visit. They talk about what they need to buy for the night's dinner. They talk about putting out the refuse. I choose a topic from our regular rotation of 3 and wade in tentatively. You speak too fast, she says. I push her slide into the pile of others to be sifted through at a later stage. I laugh, and she sees with disgust that my bottom teeth, front teeth are slightly twisted. They all talk very fast in Cork, I say. She does not think that I am funny. But it isn't the right way to speak. You should get elocution lessons, she says, and I have to look away. She thinks that I should wear a pencil skirt and have my hair combed and tied together at the nape of my neck. I could do with a trimmer waist, she thinks, and smaller breasts. I should take longer steps when I walk and keep my shoulders straight. She does not tell me any of this, but I know she thinks that this is what I should expect from myself. When she is dressed and settled, I make the tea and toast and think about how she thinks I'm ugly. I'm careful to get the honey right to the edges of the lightly toasted bread. I will the clock's hand to move. I'm anxious to get out of this kitchen and away from the sickly smell of something sour, something that is going off. Later that evening, I shower a father and a daughter. Tommy first, 18 is still at mass. We chat while we foam and clean. He is unabashed by his nakedness. He is embarrassed by the fact that it takes 2 attempts in my extended arm to get up from the shower chair. After he is dressed, Tommy insists I make us both a pot of tea while we wait for his daughter to return. We sip our tea and talk about the World Cup match. Yes, I say, it was awful rough, awful dirty. His daughter is taller than me. She does not think about the shape of her body. She has a 33-year-old body with the mind of a girl of 8. She talks a lot, whatever it is that comes into her head. Last night she told me that her mother is dead. Oh, that's hard. Do you miss her? Yes, she says, yes. Her voice does not change with what she is saying. I have to listen carefully to discern between what is statement and what is inquiry. Are Jerusalem and Galway close together? No, very far. Was David a good king? Yes, I say, I've heard he was. I dressed up as St. Mary in a play once. Wow, really? I ask her to tell me more about this. I dry her body on the bed and help her into a pink nightgown. Her face and body are round. They do not fit a girl of 8. They do not fit a woman of 33 either. I ask Aideen to sit on the bed and I plug in the hairdryer. Her long dark hair grows softer in my hands. It goes all the way down her back. I wish my hair was long and dark, I say. I had mine long, but it would never grow this long. Yes, she says, yes, unaffected. She does not understand what a compliment is. She does not know what it is to want to be different to one, how one is. She talks all the while I dry her hair. I flick the dryer on and off and try to keep up with the many destination changes that occur along her train of thought. I would like to speak like this, I think, out of sequence. I wondered why Aunt Aideen, a mother or a sister figure, or perhaps I'm more a friend, would have aged her 33. When her hair is dry, I turn down the covers and tuck her in. We sit and watch Mary Poppins for a while. What's the difference between a babysitter and a nanny? Aideen asks. A nanny lives in the house. A babysitter doesn't, I say, as if it was all as simple as that. Soon it's time for me to go. Nurse, she calls, and I find myself surprised. I've sat with her and dried her hair. She has told me about her mother. I should correct her. I mean, technically, I'm a care assistant. When it's time to leave, I say, goodbye, it was nice to meet you. She says, goodbye, nurse, in a flat voice, her eyes still on the flat screen television. My final call is to Jack's house. Oh, it's you, he says with a smile. I give him his medication and a spoonful of Gaviscon. I call it his Sambuca, as always, because I think that's what it smells like, and he laughs. What do you call it? He knows, but he wants me to say it again. Then the other care assistant, Rosemary, arrives, and there's a lot of laughter. Her laugh is loud, and I like it. She's from Kenya, but Jack always tells her about a man he worked with from Colombia, because he thinks that's where she's from. She does not correct him. You look pretty tonight, she says to me. No lipstick, though. You're not in a proms tonight. We laugh. He will never let me live that one down. No Galway man yet, then, he asks. Plenty of time yet, he thinks. I asked him once how old he thought I was, and 19 was what he said. Rosemary guessed 28, so she thinks I should be getting a move on. She had 3 of her 4 children by that age. I'm 25, I told them, but I remain 19 and 28. Do you like having green eyes? Jack asked me. I give it some thought before answering. Yes, I say, the same colour as my father's. Jack notices these things, the parts of us that aren't our uniforms. He thinks that Rosemary is beautiful too. I know this because he asks us to move him from chair to bed using the Rosemary style, and he says it again and again so that we can all laugh about it. He notices, I decide as I do, the brown silk that her Rosemary's arm is showing between the white of the gloves and the blue of her smock. She's more beautiful than yesterday, I think, although she must have looked the same. Now, Jack, we will have to do some scooching, she says, and we all laugh. Scooch is the word we use for when Jack holds onto the bar above him and shuffles his bottom to get central in the bed. Scooch, 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 we say in our own language. Scooch, scooch, scooch. Their faces switch on like lamps. When it's time to go, I say goodnight to Jack and rest a hand on his shoulder. I make sure he's snug as a bug. That I am, he says. Goodnight, safe home. The street is quiet when I step outside. I look into the faces of the people that I pass, and I think about all the different faces they must have worn that day, and the other faces I cannot see, to whom they may be ugly, or to whom they are so beautiful. There's much more than symmetry, I decide. It's an array of languages, and maths is only one of them.
Thanks, Reid. Our next reader is Trevor Conway. Trevor is from Sligo. I know we've got a Sligo contingent here tonight. Trevor mainly writes poetry, songs, and fiction. Typically, he writes about nature, society, creativity, language, and football. So you see, that's all the big themes covered. He's had his work published in several countries, including Mexico, where his poems have been translated into Spanish. He's a busy man, and he's currently working on songs, a collection of poems, and a novel. So I don't know how he found the time to be here tonight, but he is here. Please welcome Trevor Conway.
I've got 3 poems for you tonight, one long one and 2 short ones. I've got a green light shining in my face here, but anyway.
Let's go.
First poem is the long one. It's called Connected. She sees many things, windows in a whirl of colour. She sees the multitude, knows their status, the business of their lives, her place apart among them. Still she searches. A picture, some quality it has, maybe the humour of the light, takes her to a sunny weekend lying on a Turkish beach. I wonder what he's doing now, likely looking in the mirror. She considers the next trip, Stockholm, Singapore, Syracuse. He was reading that novel, 1984, telling me about it. People were leaping up and down in their places and shouting at the top of their voices. The 2 minutes hit. I really should read that. Tapping, constant tapping, like an endless echo applauding through the captured fragments of conversations. Music slips through an open window. A sound comes like a crying child, a ringtone, wailing. The name appears. Hey mum, how are things? They talk in banalities, like a train stopping on the way to a bigger town. The talk of other lives, her sister's child, a neighbor's ill health, students killed in a car crash. As the words tumble out, her thoughts creep away. This could be the last time I talk to you. I haven't even said sorry. I bought a new thing for the computer, her mother says, but I can't get it to work. Why can't I just say it? I'm sorry. Like water trickling over her toes, rising foam above her knees, a sense of pride swells inside her. Modern life, a better life than all the lives lived before. But for all the interactions, all the easy words thrown and borrowed, all the voices sounding separate notes, life seems at times a soliloquy. Her mother says goodbye. She looks at the people around her and wonders, is there anything else to search for? Moving away from what she sought, coming closer to what she needs, she feels she's always searching, her world expanding silently, hidden scaffolds and cranes, hidden workers even across the globe. She sees pages sliding out of every window, drifting through the fumes, between the wires and road signs, over cliffs, above the sea, pushed along like wandering birds. Dipping under a bridge, they rise above the jagged teeth of Sydney Opera House, floating through open windows 10 floors up. Her path is blocked. She pushes and prods, afraid to stop. She sees another window full of books with alluring titles and covers designed for intrigue. She looks inside, opens one, finds comfort in lines and curves, dots, spaces, all their sounds, the things they represent and all the feelings they produce as she moves down the page. I will wake one day and walk away through fields beyond the touch of hands, concrete huddled at a distance, my city lights will shine above. I will tread on snapping twigs, on yielding moss. The world will speak in steps and calls, time measured in shades of blue. Hair will scale down my back, I'll wipe myself with grass. My jaw will disappear like the undergrowth. Food will run, jump, or seek the sun, a traffic light to clip my flight. I will read no book, play no guitar. I will not be online, not be aware of the latest trends. I will see no pretty face, I'll see poetry everywhere. She closes it, looks around, and all she's known is a shadow, thrown against the wall, flickering by firelight. But she's been chained, unable to see the flames. Now the path is clear, she returns to her search, but in a moment reflects. What's missing from my life? I'm interesting, attractive. I have lots of friends. There's nothing wrong with living this way. Who lives without symbols? We all have a stage, a bedroom press to publish our thoughts. We are the age of the individual attached. 2 minutes hate, 2 minutes love. I'm happy. One message received off his bigger breasts, but she's found what she wants. She enters 16 digits, her personal details, and clicks to pay. Another window offers discussion, all the familiar faceless names, the same design, so many things, seen to her like a cafe. She closes the window, slams down the screen, and unfurls the bedclothes. She's offline. For my next poem, could you welcome to stage Deborah Darty again? It's a poem called On the Wing. I love the ball at my feet, running smooth over grass, each blade bending, springing back. He stands before me, keen to lunge, but I have many tricks to use as a ruse, and I'm fast. I'll step over, twist, launch myself past his shoulder. He resists, but I'll find a gap.
I follow the ball, his legs deceive, weaving a secret tapestry. I want to know his design. If he takes the line, I'll pull him back by the sleeve, but the ref won't see. He's tricky, but he's mine. I can beat him in the race and his cover behind. When I turn, I'll do it in his line.
Who's in the box? I could play it short inside, maybe get the return. I drop the shoulder, shift from right to left and back. All he'll see is a blur.
He likes to feign, but I'm no fool. And though my legs burn, their eyes will roll if I lose. Slide in hard or stay on my feet, it's all a battle of pretense. What will he do?
That's it. And my last poem is called my last poem is about how words and phrases kind of change their meaning over time, or just, you know, go away from everyone's vocabulary. It's called Out of Fashion. The bobbish bird lane shot gall to see the coddle shell at Cumberground. Every word with its season, its own peculiar taste, changes shape as it washes through a generation. Meaning can't be fastened, it hangs like a scarf ready to unravel. We wear our words like colours, choose our favourites, change according to company, advertise identity in phrase and tone. The thoughts let loose, unwrapped, frayed to threads until they pass. The dodo drew its last breath at the hands of men, revived by a child's mouth. Will cool be cold in 50 years? Centuries from now, no one will understand my words, which might be best. I'll be the enigmatic genius who said, it's been some time since I've heard the phrase, having it off.
Thanks, Trevor. Our next reader is Davnet Heary. Davnet hails from Connemara, where she lives close to the sea in sight of the Aran Islands, which I imagine must be very beautiful this time of year. She's currently working on a poetry collection, and she also writes plays, and she has a particular interest in radio drama. Her short story, The Little Girl in Pink, was shortlisted for the Francis McManus Award and was recently read out on Radio 1. Her poem Camellia will be read on Arena this week, so it's safe to say that she's going from strength to strength at the moment. Please welcome Davnet Heary.
Hi. I'm just starting to feel my age. I think I'm getting very stiff when I drive. So I'm feeling particularly stiff and I don't know what. Anyway, let's see. Light it up. I'm going to read a few poems from the Camellia series, which are in the book here, and then I'll finish with a couple of new poems which come from very different places altogether. The first one is titled The Mother Speaks. Afterbirth. The sort of thing you might expect from savages. Imagine asking for it, then taking it home and burying it in the garden to nourish the flowering shrub she'll plant on it by the kitchen door out of direct sunlight. A camellia, fancy. In my day, we incinerated them. Partner speaks. When her waters broke, she threw up the lentil soup we'd had at dinner. I chucked the rest of it into the garden and in the same spot dug the hole for the camellia. In the night, she buried the placenta, planted the shrub, and patting the raw earth, beseeched the unformed spirits not to prick her child's hand. That summer, lentils wound like wild peas through the camellia's branches, dotting them with tiny indigo flowers. The brother-in-law speaks. It was there in the fridge when I left the champagne to chill. I thought it was steak, until the mother carried in the plate and lifted up the membrane to show us the see-through sack her baby had grown in. The window was high over the street, and where the mother stood blocked the kitchen exit, so I dived for the front door, landing in the garden. I almost puked. As we were leaving, she offered us newly laid eggs, gift wrapped, dressed with parsley. I can't take them, I said. They remind me of grandfather's farm and the smell of warm milk. Camellia. Marvelling at the camellia's survival, that it endured salt, the thrashing westerlies and plain neglect, I move it to more sheltered ground, a single bud clinging still to a stripped branch, rust-burn on its crimson heart. My mother's birthday gift, in the early days of her widowhood. "Because I know you like them," she'd said, having driven alone across the barren, her gesture reining in memories of harsh words, our silence salve to the wounds. "I see my daughter beaming from that sunny photo, the grey tabby trapped mid-leap in her firm arms, her scratched fingers testimony to earlier phrase and the original camellia that flourished on her placenta, displaying the blooms that frame her blonde head." And from a different phase, this poem is titled in the book "The Birth Mother Speaks," but I changed it now to "Weaning." Weaning. "They're cut now, these cruel canines, and me too, freed. I've served my time, being chewed and bitten, over and back, that gum gnawing, grinding has my nipples zinging electric, verging on combustion, takeoff. This is the day for weaning. I make a bran poultice of sage and parsley, add vinegar to disguise the scent, wrap my breasts in cabbage leaves, and hike into the wilderness, the child on my back. All day I parry requests for titty, walk the tracks, rest, walk, sleep. The child puzzles where the milk has gone. Up to the sky, I say, pointing to the jet planes trailing drip." From someplace very different. This poem, "Ancestral Fowls," I won't go into any background. "Ancestral Fowls." "There they were, two of them, perched, a pair of moths on a branch, or a couple of banshees, their grey tendrils hanging out to dry. They sat, soundless and still, their black bean eyes beady in skull sockets, their beaks flattened to heart-shaped faces, ghostly in the half-light. They seemed ancestral, benign, and they drew me in. While I held their gaze, not a moment moved, nor breath exhaled, no pulse throbbed. Now I'm full of owls, 10 at least on my torso, 6 or 7 down my legs and more on each arm. Commedia dell'arte masks cover me all over. Their characters are peering through. They use my voice. But I don't know who they are or why they're here." Another poem from...
Thanks, Sadness. Sorry if I really cut you off on your time there. The final reader is myself. I'm David Doherty, and I'm not going to refer to myself in the third person, so I'll just introduce myself. I'm a fiction writer whose main areas of interest are black humour and satire. My work has been published in Ropes and Bird Eggs, and I've also written drama and comedy for radio and stage. I'm currently working on a collection of short stories that are based on 70 descendants. They're comedic. So what I'm going to read is... it's an excerpt from Winter Wonderland, which is this story I have in the anthology. Just a bit of backdrop. The story is set at Christmas, Christmas Fair at City Centre Park. The main character, who is Billy, has brought his son Adam to meet Santa, and that's where we take it from. Okay. photo points offering souvenir snaps with assorted elves, reindeer, and snowmen dotted the park. A memento of the occasion would be nice. Billy took Adam's hand. What do you fancy, son?
A reindeer.
How about Rudolph? Billy pointed to the left, where a dour man in a reindeer costume and bulbous red nose sat smoking.
Yeah.
Rudolph stubbed out his cigarette and posed with the pair in front of a backdrop of snowy meadows. Are you really Rudolph? Asked Adam, as Billy paid the photographer.
Sure am.
Rudolph grimaced and lit another cigarette. What's it like working with Santa? A loud crackle emanated from Rudolph's waist. Hotel Oscar, Hotel Oscar, Hotel Oscar, come in, over. Hotel Oscar, Hotel Oscar, Hotel Oscar here, over. Operation Sierra Alpha, November, Tango, Alpha, commencing, over. Copy that, over and out. Rudolph kicked off his walkie-talkie, reached under the table, and slipped into a Garda high-vis jacket. It's your chance to meet him, lad. Santa's coming into the park now. You won't want to miss this. Smoke steamed through Rudolph's nostrils as he took one last drag. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got work to do. Adam grabbed his father's hand and led him through the crowd that now swept towards the rear entrance. Santa was about to arrive. Smiling parents led shiny-eyed children. Anticipation built as they reached the rear gates that faced out onto a looming Gothic building. Adam peered up in wonder at the towering edifice that housed the local brewery. Dominated by horizontal black stucco and white walls and a large central arch, the brewery possessed an intimidating quality. A gargantuan black and white clock hung over the main entrance, its wrought iron hands sweeping silently around black Roman numerals. Fully lit, the brewery assumed a nightmarish hue. It was a place that a young Billy had always dreaded passing at night, convinced that Freddy Krueger or Michael Myers was about to leap out from behind the railings. Now the macabre atmosphere was offset by rows of white fairy lights that hung in parallel rows in the yard. The crowd surged forward as they spotted movement at the brewery entrance. The decaying oak doors swung open. Santa, accompanied by Sergeant Tim O'Regan, emerged and saluted the crowd before entering the back of a waiting Garda car. Children cheered and waved as the car made a short journey across the road. Billy hoisted Adam up on his shoulders for a better view. The carriers, who had moved from the front gate, struck up to soundtrack the moment.
Later on, we'll conspire.
The car trundled by the park's famous Bruce Hart Fountain as it crawled towards the stage. Water gushed through aortas and pulmonary arteries. Dozens of eager revelers beat the car, pressing their hands and faces onto the glass, straining for a glimpse of Santa.
As we dream by the fire.
Adam peered through the window as Santa passed by. He looked intimidated by the crowd, his hands held together close to his chest, his neck tucked into his beard. It was almost as if he wanted to disappear.
To face unafraid.
What's wrong with Santa, Dad? He doesn't look happy. That's what happens when everyone wants a piece of his son. Don't worry, I'm sure he'll be fine.
The plans that we've made.
The car finally came to a halt. Sergeant Tim stepped from the passenger seat and doffed his cap at the crowd. A huge cheer went up as the sergeant opened the door, allowing Santa to set foot in the park. Christmas had arrived. The sergeant took Santa by the elbow and led him onto a large wooden chair at the centre of the stage.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
Rudolph came on stage with two elves, clutching large cloth bags full of gift-wrapped presents. Red parcels for girls were placed to Santa's left, silver boys' parcels to the right. Sergeant Tim approached the microphone and held out his hands to request silence from the feverish throng.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, on behalf of the City Council and Garda Síochána, I'd like to welcome you to the first night of the first ever People's Park Winter Wonderland Festival. Before I begin, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you all for coming tonight, and it's especially encouraging to see so many young families lending their support to what we hope will become an annual event. Billy and Adam, who had moved to a vantage point three or four rows back to the left of the joint ash, joined in the applause. Glancing down at his son, Billy felt his fingers tingling with anticipation and thought of Grace. He hoped that she was watching.
I'm sure you're all eager to get on with the festivities, so I won't keep you long.
First Sunday itinerary is a distribution of presents by Santa to all the children who've been good this year. I hope you've all been good now, huh? After meeting Santa, the children will enjoy a Christmas party at the brewery under the care of Santa's little helpers. The sergeant paused to discharge the contents of his esophagus. This will be followed by a meet and greet session for selected adult ticket holders. Once this is finished, we'll have the main event.
Woo-hoo!